my guest this morning is Dr. Kate Rayum Blue. Her book is Vitamin K2 and the Calcium Paradox. Thank you so much for joining us today, Kate.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
First, I'd like to say that I did read the book, and it's very interesting. So much of the information is really astonishing, and it was well written and just kept me turning the pages, and it was very clear in the way that it was written, unlike some other books I've read.
Well, thanks. It's nice to hear that, and it was actually astonishing to research and write it and find out how much information there was, you know, that really existed about this vitamin that is really not talked about at all.
Well, so since I've read the book, let me see if I've absorbed the information correctly. Would it be correct for me to say that vitamin K2 comes from the fats in grass-fed animals?
That is a main source of it in our diet, or it used to be a main source of it in our diet when we were eating grass-fed animals on a regular basis.
And so there is also some other sources for it that would be considered vegan, possibly?
Yes, one source in particular, a fermented food called natto. It's a Japanese fermented soybean food. That would be a vegan source of this nutrient.
And there's also another synthesized source that people could get as well?
When people are shopping for supplements, one of the forms that they'll find in products labeled as MK4, which we can get into later on, is a synthetic source.
So there's a couple choices there for vegans so that they can still get the benefits of the K2.
That's right. And certainly this is one that's especially important for people who are following a vegan or vegetarian diet.
So I got interested in this subject because of dental health, and so I'm also reading that vitamins A and D are important for dental health, and people who are vegan have also asked me if they can still follow this type of a protocol. So the question would be, is there plant sources for vitamin A and vitamin D?
Unfortunately, there are not. Vitamin D in particular is really exclusively derived from animal sources. There are synthetic forms of vitamin D that you can get. Vitamin D2 in particular is made from an irradiated mushroom or irradiated fungus, but it really doesn't work as well in the body. So I would say to vegans that maybe this would be a concession they could make to a generally healthy lifestyle or particular choices in their eating patterns to preserve their health, that this one particular nutrient does come from that source. Vitamin A is also challenging to get from animal sources. People know that you can...
You mean from plant sources?
Excuse me, from plant sources. Thank you. From plant sources. The body can convert some beta-carotene to vitamin A, although that really varies how much conversion is made depending on the person and what health conditions that you might have. So you can't always count on beta-carotene to give you as much vitamin A as you need, and the direct sources of vitamin A are also from animal foods, but that's something that you'd have to delve into more. And I do have a whole chapter, as you know, devoted to that in the book.
Right, and what I found very interesting in that chapter was you were saying the higher the content of beta-carotene in the food, the harder it is for your body to convert it into vitamin A.
And that's so strange because, you know, we think of foods very high in beta-carotene, like carrots, for example, as being good sources of vitamin A, but in fact, somehow it seems to overwhelm the body, and the conversion of the beta-carotene to vitamin A is inhibited. So that's something that you have to kind of to weigh out to look at the food sources that you're getting.
And you also mentioned that people who are dealing with alcoholism, that also disrupts their ability to convert the vitamin A into retinol.
That's right. Alcoholism, even diabetes, thyroid conditions, children, for example, under the age of 5, they don't make a good conversion between either beta-carotene to vitamin A, so they need these preformed nutrients in their diet.
So it also brings us to another interesting point of golden rice and why genetically modified rice with beta-carotene won't help people.
Yeah, that is such a, I'm sure it comes from a good place to try to genetically modify rice so it includes beta-carotene as a source of vitamin A for people who don't have that, but when that kind of a program is replacing the traditional programs of straight vitamin A supplementation that people would be getting, then the recipients of this are probably not, you know, as well off. They're worse off, really, because if they have any kind of health condition, intestinal parasite, for example, is common in the tropics, they can't make that conversion, and the golden rice is essentially useless or not giving them the kind of nutrition that they would be getting from a vitamin A supplementation program.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you mentioned a study on atherosclerosis, and it was they're able to reduce the amount of it in 6 weeks by 50%, I believe, just from memory.
Yes.
And do you know how the amount of arterial plaque was measured?
Yeah, it was measured using a scanning procedure that checks for the absolute presence of calcium in the arterial tissue. And, of course, calcium, when we talk about hardening of the arteries, this is a buildup of a plaque that is primarily made up of calcium, or rather it has calcium as its structure. And the presence of calcium in arterial tissues has been shown to correlate with the risk of cardiovascular disease, specifically the risk of having a heart attack, much more so than cholesterol or any other measure that we have. So the particular study that I was referring to in the book was an animal study. So they looked at the buildup of calcium plaque in animal arteries and showed that vitamin K2 could reduce the amount of this calcification by up to 50% in as little as 6 weeks. Now, more recent studies have come out since the book was published just this past summer, which was a clinical trial, which showed that individuals who are taking K2 supplements in this particular study have also reduced the amount of calcium plaque and hardening of the arteries.
So are they measuring that then with an X-ray that's showing the calcification?
Yeah, in the human clinical trials, yeah, it's essentially a CT scan, which is showing the presence of calcium plaque in the arteries.
One of the maybe most mind-blowing parts of the book, or shocking, scary parts, is that you say arterial wall calcification can include fully formed bone tissue, including bone marrow.
That was absolutely bizarre, and it turns out that this process of calcification in the arteries is mediated by the very same cells, or cells that are very similar to those that would build bone, and so it really is a process of almost bone formation in the arteries. And the strange thing is that's often, you often see this in people who are suffering with osteoporosis, which is a lack of bone formation in the bones where you want it to be. So vitamin K2 has been shown to correct this, put things back into balance. So build bone where you want bone to be,
mm-hmm.
and take it out of arteries and other, you know, areas of soft tissue where we don't want calcification and bone formation to happen.
Mm-hmm. So would it be, which is the bone builder and which is the one that breaks down bone when it comes to osteoclasts and osteoblasts?
Oh, okay. So we can think of blasts as building. So osteoblasts are bone-building cells, and the clasts are the breakdown ones. Probably when we're thinking about vitamin K2, it's helpful to consider the different proteins. So essentially what vitamin K2 does, as you know from reading the book, is activating proteins in the body. There's one set of proteins that will take calcium and guide it into your bones and teeth where you want it. That's called osteocalcin. And another set of proteins called MGP, which will remove calcium from where you don't want it to be, whether that's your heart valves, your coronary arteries, and other places like that. And so that's sort of what moves calcium around.
I'm sorry, what was the second one called?
MGP. It stands for matrix GLA protein, and that's the protein that will essentially remove calcium from where it shouldn't be once it's activated by vitamin K2.
So that leads me to another question, which is you talk about how the K2 can break down unwanted calcium, and you were basically saying that if you have a deficiency of K2, then the calcium is going to build up in soft tissues in the body. And that can be in the, it would affect your arterial walls. That's the first, or the, I don't know how to say it, but it's the site that it likes to occur first. Is that right?
It's definitely a site of susceptibility, and it's probably the site that we focus on because, of course, that it poses the most health risk when calcium does build up in our arteries.
So I was also wondering if other calcifying conditions could also be related to this, such as bone spurs, cataracts, some types of kidney stones, calcified salivary glands, calcified pineal gland, tartar on the teeth. Do you think all those would be, or have they been proven to be?
Absolutely. Some of them have been outright proven to be. Others have shown that the same vitamin K2-dependent proteins that would be a problem in, say, bone loss or hardening of the arteries are also present in those tissues, kidney stones, for example. Mm. And certainly in practice, I have seen a number of surprising resolutions of strange calcifications, like heel spurs, bone spurs, little calcifications here or there that maybe aren't life-threatening, but certainly bothersome, and clinically you can see the change here when vitamin K2 is introduced, that it just seems to clean up inappropriate calcification in many areas of the body. And dental plaque, the one you mentioned there, tartar on the teeth, is one of those.
Mm. Do you know if cataracts has been proven to be one?
Cataracts is one that hasn't been examined or hasn't been studied, and there's a combination of a calcium deposit as well as antioxidant deficiencies happening with that, as there really is in the arteries as well. But that's one I think that deserves more attention and more research.
Mm. So you say that K1 could be marginally converted in the gut into K2, but not very well. Are there things that we can do to improve our body's ability to do this conversion?
Well, certainly when we eat vitamin K1, you know, most people when they hear vitamin K, they're thinking of vitamin K1, which is found in green leafy vegetables, and that's primarily a blood clotting nutrient. But we can convert a very small amount of this in the gut, and it's our gut bacteria that do this. We can convert K1 to K2. It has not been shown that we can do this in high enough quantities to prevent a deficiency. In other words, human beings have pretty much always relied on dietary sources of preformed K2 to meet our needs. However, if you are concerned or want to make sure that you're going to optimize the K1 conversion that you could have, then making sure that you have good gut flora. So whether that's through a probiotic supplementation or eating lots of fermented foods, and many fermented foods are actually high in vitamin K2 already, mm-hmm. but just making sure that you have good bacteria in your intestines, because they're the ones that will make that conversion.
With fluoride, I've heard that fluoride can cause calcification of pineal gland, and I wonder if there's any studies with fluoride calcification and how it relates to K2.
Well, that's something that has come up because, K2 has such an important role in dental health, and there's a fair bit of historical research on vitamin K2 before it was even identified to be K2 that pertains to dental health. And so when we're talking about dental health, we automatically consider fluoride. And certainly the early researchers on vitamin K2 were not proponents of fluoride and realized that K2 was one of the important nutrients that would occur naturally in our diet that would help maintain our teeth and keep it strong, versus giving high amounts of fluoride, which was completely unnatural and ultimately would have adverse effects on the teeth as well as other areas of the body. Now, that's another area of research that hasn't been pursued as much, but we see similar patterns of inappropriate calcification with fluoride as we do with K2 deficiencies. So there's certainly a relationship there.
And I think with fluorosis, you can also get it in the skeleton, and it weakens, it makes the bones more brittle. Is that right?
Yeah, the skeleton and, ironically, the teeth.
And speaking of the skeleton, that was another part of the book that was shocking and amazing, that the skeleton is not just a scaffolding for the body, but it's an endocrine gland that produces insulin.
Yeah, that was really surprising. This is research that came out in 2007 that shows that the bones will actually secrete osteocalcin, which is a protein which will help them, the bones themselves, grow and become stronger and harder. But this protein also affects our health in other areas of the body. It improves insulin sensitivity, which ultimately means that the density of our bones can have an effect on the development of diabetes, as well as male fertility in particular and the production of sperm in the testicles. So this is really surprising to think that the health of our bones ultimately can affect our endocrine system and the health of many areas of our body.
Yes. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the dentist Melvin Page, but I started reading a lot of different dental books, and Melvin Page was studying his patients with tooth decay and found that with certain patients, if he gave them insulin, he could stop their tooth decay.
And, very interesting.
Wondering
yep.
if you could say more, if that would spark any ideas for you in relation to K2 and...
I probably have to sit down and think about the mechanism there, but we certainly see a much higher incidence, you know, there's conditions that we see together, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, these all are often found in a constellation, you know, they used to be called metabolic syndrome or syndrome X, and there are certain common underlying factors to these conditions, so rather than treating them separately, we can look at what the underlying commonalities are, and vitamin K2 is one that keeps coming up again and again as important for all these health concerns, and particularly it's recently been shown that dentists can even identify individuals who are at higher risk for having diabetes or possibly have undiagnosed diabetes just by doing a dental exam and an examination of the mouth. So the health of the mouth is so important, and it is a predictor of the health of really the rest of the body.
Do you know what it is that they specifically are looking for in the mouth when they find diabetes?
Yep, they're looking at the health of the gums, periodontal disease, the depth of the sulcus, which is the area between the tooth and the gum, and if that is enlarged or the gums seem inflamed, there's a much higher rate of diabetes and heart disease.
So you say in the book that using the K2, that can help people who are type 2 diabetic to have less problems with that, or to resensitize them to insulin?
Yeah, vitamin K2 has been shown to help improve insulin sensitivity. So for individuals with type 2 diabetes, that's ultimately the problem, is that their body isn't responding to their own insulin, and K2 has been shown to help with that.
So then would it also stand to reason the connection between the gums and the diabetes, that if you're supplementing with K2, it's going to help the gums? And you may have mentioned that in the book, but I may not be remembering that.
You know, I just barely touched on that in the book, but I have to say that is the one thing, since I've written this book and published it, I get the most emails out of that people are contacting me saying, since they've been taking K2 or increasing the K2 in their diet, that they have found that the plaque is clearing away from their teeth and calculus just sort of crumbling off their teeth. Some individuals who said that they had been scheduled for gum surgery due to deteriorating gums, and their gums had been stopped deteriorating and actually started healing, and they were able to avoid surgery. So you know, a lot of the conditions that we see with vitamin K2, bone health and heart health, those aren't obvious when they're getting better or worse, but certainly the health of the mouth is one where we can really see this effect, and you know, based on the people who are emailing me, people can notice a difference in their mouth and with their oral health once they increase their K2 intake.
And the people who are emailing you about this particular concern, do you know which type of K2 they're taking, if it's the MK4 or the MK7?
Typically, it's the MK7. So this is the natural bacterial-derived form of vitamin K2. And that's the one that I recommend in the book, because it has a number of benefits in terms of convenience in dosing and the effect that it has in the body. And most people who email me, that's the form that they've been taking.
And I think that I read on a... some blog or bulletin board that people had said that they were taking the MK7 and it was making their gums bleed, so they switched to the MK4.
Oh, I haven't seen that before.
Which is, you know, completely anecdotal.
Yeah, I have not heard that one before.
Okay. I was wondering if any of your research has brought forth information about steroid-caused bone diseases and if K2 can help with things like osteonecrosis?
Now, that's a tricky one. So far from what I've seen in the research and what I wrote about in the book is that taking corticosteroids, anti-inflammatory medications for a long period of time, we know that this has a negative effect on the bone, and it tends to cause deterioration of bone density in a way or by a mechanism that vitamin K2 doesn't seem to help with a lot. And certainly while people are taking those medications, anti-inflammatory steroid medications, the K2 doesn't seem to help improve bone density. Now, often individuals on those meds, they may have other reasons for their bone deterioration as well, but that seems to be a tricky one at this point because of the way that those drugs affect the bones.
Well, does it still not work even after they've stopped taking the steroids?
No. Once they've stopped taking the steroid medications, then vitamin K2 will still have a beneficial effect on the bones as it does in everyone else.
Mm.
So the question is, how much of their bone can they recover?
Mm-hmm.
And that remains to be seen. But I've heard some very preliminary anecdotal good evidence. We just need to see a little bit more of that.
I have two friends who are suffering from this. One has osteopenia, the other has osteonecrosis. And one of them was on 90 milligrams of cortisone
mm-hmm.
A day for 6 years.
Oh,
which
wow.
He was told that he has a malpractice suit that he could
I would think so, yeah.
Move forward with. But the problem is that it's left his body in this condition of having this disease, and it seems like over time it's not getting any better. I guess I'm wondering, do you know what the mechanism is that makes these overdoses of steroids deteriorate the bone?
Yes, and it gets a little bit complicated. Certainly he should be able to, if he's working with a practitioner who is familiar with the effects of these medications, be able to recover, because these have effects on the whole body, including not just the bones, and regain the bone density as well as go through a process to regain his health in general.
Mm-hmm.
But he'd sort of have to look at, on a specific basis, his where his health is at now, as well as his health history.
Mm-hmm. And then also to touch on the dental health, you say traditional Chinese medicine says that the heart opens into the mouth, which I thought was an interesting idea.
Yeah, the heart opens into the mouth. It is an idea from traditional Chinese medicine, but one that has been now very much supported by modern medicine, in which, I gave the example before of dentists being able to predict those who are at risk for diabetes and heart disease just by doing an oral health exam, or other research that shows that bacteria from the mouth and from the teeth can gain access to the bloodstream and ultimately affect your heart health. And so there really is a connection between the mouth and the cardiovascular system and the heart in particular. And you can see a lot about the health of those organs by looking into the mouth.
Are you familiar with the book Cure Tooth Decay by Rami Nagel?
I have not read it, but I am familiar with it and know of it. I know it's very popular.
So I was excited to read his book about tooth decay, and it had a lot of great information, but I was surprised that he didn't have the information that you had about Weston Price's research taking chips of teeth and putting them into the saliva of patients who were K2 deficient and then patients who had a sufficiency of K2. And could you tell us what happened when he did that?
Yeah, that was really interesting research. So Weston Price, who is the famous dentist who traveled around the world to discover, healthy people, find healthy people and discover what made them and kept them healthy, and ultimately, of course, this boiled down to diet, he was able to create a very concentrated extract of vitamin K2. He was talking about or called it Activator X, because at the time the identity of the nutrient was not identified, wasn't discovered. And he used this in looking at dental health. He recognized that this was very important for preventing and treating dental cavities. And one of the reasons that this happened was that this nutrient seemed to encourage minerals to move into bone. And so he specifically took bone chips and tooth chips and mixed them with the saliva of individuals before and after giving this concentrated vitamin K2 supplement from grass-fed butter. And he showed that once this was present, this nutrient was present, that it caused minerals to move into the bone, which is, of course, where you want it to be for strong teeth. And when the nutrient was missing, that minerals like calcium would move out of the bone into saliva. So in other words, when we're missing this nutrient, our saliva is essentially leaching minerals from our teeth. And when the nutrient is present, that encourages those minerals like calcium to move into the bones and teeth where we want them to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was interesting, too, because in Cure2CK, he was talking about two dental researchers who came up with the theory of dentinal fluid transport, which is fluid from your intestines coming up and secreting out through the microscopic tubes in your teeth. And they were talking about when your diet was one way or another, the fluid would either flow into your teeth or out of your teeth. And they were saying that fluid flowing out of your teeth is a positive thing. So maybe those are just two different mechanisms that are working side by side.
It could be. One is looking more at a circulation aspect versus the movement of the minerals themselves.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you if coconut oil has any fat-soluble vitamins that we know of.
I'm not an expert on coconut oil, but I certainly know it's one that is very healthy, certainly one I include in my diet and recommend to patients, and it seems to have a number of healthful properties. It doesn't have the same concentration of fat-soluble vitamins, say A, D, and K2. That doesn't come up high on the list of those nutrients, but it's still considered to be a healthy fat.
Mm-hmm. At this time, I'd like to open the phone lines if there's anyone out there who has a question for Dr. Kate. You can call us here at the station. The phone number is 859-4200. Again, that number is 859-4200. And K2 in our diet, what went wrong? That's one of your chapters. Could you tell us what went wrong?
Yeah, well, it's very simply, it talks about, you know, how we used to, this nutrient used to be abundant in our diets back when animals, cows, chickens, pigs, all of those creatures were regularly out in the pasture, out on grass. And when those animals are feeding on grass, then we have lots of vitamin K2 in the animal foods that we used to consume, like eggs, egg yolks in particular, butter, the fat and the meat and the organ meat of animals that eat grass. And when we did away with pastured animals, or rather we took animals off the pasture and put them into confined grain feeding sort of factory farming situations, we did away with vitamin K2, because when animals don't have grass in their diet, then we miss out on this nutrient. There's another aspect to the loss of K2 in our diets, and that has to do with the consumption of fermented foods. So even if you can't get access to grass-fed foods, there are certain types of fermented foods where the bacteria that do the fermentation will make K2. So I give a list in the book. Some cheeses are very high, brie cheese and gouda cheese. These are a couple of high ones that it doesn't matter if the milk that went into the cheese was grass-fed. Those foods will still be high in vitamin K2.
Mm-hmm. Also, in the book Cure2CK, Rami Nagel said it was suspected that K2 comes from plant steroids in rapidly growing grass. Do you know if that? Do you think that that's true, or it's coming from the K1?
That's right. So what happens is when the grass is growing rapidly, so any kind of green grass will have vitamin K1 in it, and it's been shown that when the grass is growing quickly, it has a higher concentration of the nutrients, K1 in particular, that when animals eat that rapidly growing grass, they'll convert it to more K2. So there's always been a natural fluctuation in the levels of K2 throughout the year. It's of course low in the winter time when there's no grass, higher in the summer, but there are peaks typically in the spring and the fall when the grass is growing very quickly, and that's when we see even more K2 in those grass-fed foods.
So if people were to be juicing wheatgrass, that's not going to be giving them the K2?
No, unfortunately it won't. It will give you lots of K1 because that's what the grass contains, but studies, that has definitely been studied, that we really don't efficiently make K1, or we can't really efficiently boost our K2 levels, rather, from taking green foods or even wheatgrass foods that are high in K1. Those foods are, of course, still good for us, but won't efficiently increase our K2 levels.
The book shows the difference between a Netherlands egg yolk and a U.S. egg yolk. And the Netherlands has 32.1, I didn't know what the units was.
Micrograms.
Micrograms of K2, and the U.S. egg had 15.5 micrograms.
Yeah, so that was about double, and that likely reflects the difference in the way those eggs are produced and raised. You know, an egg is not just an egg. The typical U.S. egg is likely to have coming from a factory farming situation, or even if it's a cage-free hen, which is nice, it's typically exclusively a grain-fed hen. So that will have a little bit of K2, but fairly low amounts, compared to a hen that is either out on pasture or has some green foods or herbs in its diet.
So I was wondering if you could recommend any tips so I could close the gap. We raise chickens, and our chickens are outdoors on grass. So would it be likely that we're closer to the Netherlands egg?
Very much so, yes. That's really as good as it gets when it comes to eggs.
Uh-huh.
And I'm guessing that your hens lay eggs with quite orange-looking egg yolks?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's usually the sign. So the orange color comes from beta-carotene, but that often comes along hand-in-hand with high levels of vitamin K2. So it's probably been a while since, if you have your own eggs, probably been a while since you've seen a store-bought egg, but you'd be shocked at how pale and pathetic and anemic-looking those yolks are. And then you know that those orange yolks are the ones that are really high in vitamin K2.
I see. I did have a caller, and caller, if you could call back, I lost you, but if you can call back, I'll get you back on the air. And just to ask you about that orange color, now, our chickens are on grass, but the yolks are not always orange, and we've heard that some farmers who feed their chickens a lot of soy, they tend to get an oranger yolk, and we feed them a soy-free feed. Oh, well, before you answer that, the other caller is back, so.
Okay, sure.
Thank you. WHCL.
Hi, I have a question for the doctor.
Sure, you're on the air.
I'd like to know, I have osteoporosis, and I've noticed that there is K2, and there's M4 formulas and M7 formulas, and I wonder which one would be more recommended for my condition.
Sure.
Good question. The most recent clinical trials have focused on the MK7 form of the nutrient for bone health, and the biggest difference is the dosing. So with MK7, you want to have about 200 micrograms, that's MCG, per day. And then with the MK4 form, you're looking at 45 milligrams. So really, I do recommend the MK7, and the most recent clinical trials for bone health have focused on that. So if you're shopping for supplements, then check out and look for the MK7 form.
Thank you, caller. If you have any more questions, give us a call back. Unfortunately, I can't keep you both on conference call because it lowers the volume of you, Dr. Kate, when you're responding.
Okay.
So just a note to callers. If you have any more insights about the orange color of the egg yolks?
Oh, right. So, I mean, the beta-carotene content of their feed, which, you know, we know with animals or chickens that are on green grass, they'll have high beta-carotene content. That is a major factor in the color of the yolks, but there certainly are other things that will affect it. So even for individuals, I know I get my eggs nearby from a farmer who raises his chickens exclusively on pasture out in the fields, but there are still sometimes variations depending on the age of the hens, if there's new ones in the flock, the rations that they give them as well, and there's a number of variables that for one reason or another, sometimes the color of the egg yolks will change a little bit.
Mm. And I wonder, is there ever instances where the chickens are less inclined to eat grass, even though they're on grass?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Yeah, but it seems to be something that they enjoy having, the grass and the bugs and what comes with it.
Mm-hmm. Are vitamins destroyed by heat, like the A, D, and vitamin K2?
Somewhat. Certainly, you know, of the list of K2 foods in the book, you can see that heating or cooking those foods will diminish the K2 content a little bit. It won't completely destroy it or obliterate it, but there is some reduction in the K2 when you cook foods like liver, for example.
Mm-hmm. And does eating liver provide the proper ratios of A, D, and K2?
Liver is an excellent source of vitamin A, you know, the best traditional source. Once upon a time, everybody made their kids eat liver once a week, and then that was just something that you did, and that got your vitamin A intake for sure. Not necessarily high, well, not high in vitamin D typically. Some types of liver is high in K2, like goose liver. Goose liver is one of the highest foods in vitamin K2. But it varies depending on the type of liver. So liver is always a good source of vitamin A, not usually a good source of vitamin D, and it may have some K2 in it depending on the type of liver.
But there isn't one food that you would be eating possibly that would contain all of them in the proper ratio?
No, because vitamin D is typically taken from sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't very many foods that are very high in vitamin D. There are certain types of fish, and I guess some types of fish liver that would have some D, but mostly humans would have been getting our vitamin D from sun exposure. So that's why not many foods are high in vitamin D.
Are you familiar with the Blue Ice fermented cod liver oils?
Yes.
Book I have here is saying that the amount in one teaspoon of vitamin D would be 3,500 to 10,000 international units.
Hmm. Well, I'd have to check that up because I don't know the ratios on the top of my head. I know
right.
That is a good cod liver oil, of course, is a great source of vitamins A and often vitamins D as well. And the fermented cod liver oils in particular are a nice addition to the diet for sources of fat-soluble nutrients.
And you can also get the fermented cod liver oil mixed with the butter, the high vitamin butter oil, so that would have the K2 as well?
That's right, although the high vitamin butter oil is not standardized for K2 content.
I see.
So you don't know for sure how much K2 you're getting, and for that's the one reason why I am not. I don't recommend that product because I don't know how much you're getting, and it would vary from batch to batch.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know exactly.
Which brings us to another interesting point, which is how spreadable is your butter?
Oh yeah, and that is often how spreadable your butter is a factor of what kinds of fats are in the butter, and that goes hand in hand with the kind of fat-soluble vitamins that you'll find in your butter. And butter used to be spreadable even when it was cold, because when animals are out on the pasture again and they've got grass in their diet, that leads to a lots of unsaturated fatty acids, those omega-3 fatty acids that we're always looking for in our diet, and that makes the butter very soft. But unfortunately, soft butter doesn't ship very well. So butter producers began to put cottonseed and other types of seed into the cow's diet to have them produce milk that would make hard butter. And hard butter is more convenient for shipping, but it's not nearly as good for our health. And so how spreadable your butter is really an indicator of the types of fats and fat-soluble vitamins that you'll find in your butter.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just an interesting point about the history and how food, the industrialization of food has caused these deficiencies. And you'd also mentioned earlier about the cows and animals being in the confined indoor conditions that it reduced their K2 content. In the book, you said that's only because of the discovery of vitamin D or vitamin A and D that they could keep them indoors.
Both of them, yes. That's the ironic thing. They couldn't really successfully keep animals indoors or rather in confined feedlots. In other words, they had to put them out on the pasture because the pasture was giving them some nutrients that kept them alive and healthy. And once they isolated that, those two main nutrients that did that were vitamins A and D, this allowed producers, beef and dairy producers, to put animals in feedlots and then just give them supplements of the vitamin A and D. And so that allowed them to survive, certainly not thrive, but survive under those conditions and produce meat and dairy under those conditions. But what was missing was the vitamin K2. And so then we ended up sacrificing that in our foods.
Mm. And toward the end of the book, you mentioned in the that the paleo diet excludes the use of salt, and I was just thinking about that. You're talking about animals out on pasture, and they give them salt licks. I thought that salt was necessary for the body, but maybe not.
Oh, salt is definitely necessary for the body, and I don't recall whether I commented on the paleo use of salt in the diet, but I'm sure Paleolithic eaters would have found sources of salt, because those would have been very important sources of minerals, and we do need that. You know, when we sweat, we are losing not just water, but salt and minerals as well, and we need that to balance our body, and it's certainly part of a healthy diet.
Mm. In the book, you talk about researchers inducing vitamin K2 deficiency. I was curious if you know how they're able to do that.
In which section were you talking about that the K2 deficiency?
I think it was about in the insulin part when they were researching that, they were able to, researchers induced vitamin K2 deficiency, and then the it was found that the mice or rats in the study began to get diabetes.
Oh, right. So you can do that experimentally in animal studies by limiting the either vitamin K2 intake or the precursors of K2 intake, like vitamin K1, because rodents will make that conversion. Experimental animals, if you give them vitamin K1, you can alter their K2 levels in their body quite readily.
Interesting. And another technical question, these are just kind of the things that I wonder about while reading the book, the little details, is how is the K2 MK4 extracted or synthesized from tobacco?
Oh, it's a chemical reaction that they can perform in a laboratory. It's not dissimilar to the way some forms of coenzyme Q10 are made. Actually, the shape of those structures are similar, so they can do a series of enzymatic reactions that in the end produce this vitamin K2.
Okay. K2, friend or foe of blood thinning medications. I thought that was interesting because we hear about K1 and its relation to blood thinners, and so people are not wanting to eat the leafy green vegetables.
That's right, and that is certainly the bane of many natural health practitioners, because so many people are on these medicines, and then there's a long list of healthy foods that they're supposed to avoid. But the fact is that knowing that, you'd expect K2 to be completely forbidden when people are on blood thinners. But I do highly recommend anybody who's taking a blood thinning medication to read that section in the book that pertains to that, or show it to their doctor, because essentially, up to a certain level, vitamin K2 has been shown to help prevent the side effects associated with blood thinning medications without interfering with the efficacy of those meds. And that is been proven scientifically in published studies, and that's really important information to have, because it will help you benefit from those medicines without running the risk of the side effects.
Again, I'd like to mention to the listeners, if you're just tuning in, my guest is Dr. Kate Rayon-Blue, and her book is Vitamin K2 and the Calcium Paradox. If you have any questions, you'd like to reach us here in the station, the telephone number is 859-4200, 859-4200. 4200. Primarily, I got your book to read about dental health, but even, you know, and I was thinking of skipping all these other chapters that didn't apply to me, like the being on the blood-thinning medications, but it was just so fascinating. You know, all of these things just get you thinking about how intricate these relationships in the body are.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and that's what was interesting about researching it, was to just discover the connections in areas where we maybe didn't see connections before, but then once you do see it, it makes a lot of sense.
What made you want to write this book?
Well, I sort of tuned into the emerging research of vitamin K2 a few years back, maybe 2007, and immediately became very interested because I realized that this was a nutrient that is as important in our diets and in our health as vitamin D, and we've heard so much about vitamin D. And these two nutrients work together, D and K2, and yet K2 wasn't being discussed at all. And the more I delved into it, the more I realized there's actually a whole lot of research about vitamin K2, its effect on cancer, its importance in fertility and growing healthy children, and really so many conditions, and that it has been, you know, gone missing from our diet because of the way we have changed the way we produce our food, so this whole industrialization of our food. So there's a pretty interesting backstory to the nutrient, as well as so much modern research and so many important health benefits, and yet nobody was talking about it. And so I assumed somebody at some point would write a book, and nobody did, so then I realized I had to be the one to write the book. And especially in light of and how I opened the book is with the studies coming out around calcium supplementation, and I know that everybody is taking calcium supplements, and studies show that that in fact this may be increasing heart attack and stroke in individuals who take calcium. And so then the question is not necessarily should we or shouldn't we be taking calcium or is calcium safe, but rather how does the body safely utilize calcium? And it turns out you need vitamin K2 to guide calcium where you want it to be. So there really are so many different factors that played into writing the book. And the story of vitamin K2 is not just about a nutrient or even about just nutrition, but it really encompasses what we have lost to this industrialization of our food and what we stand to gain by getting back to the old-fashioned ways of farming and eating.
Mm. Are you familiar with Dr. Ray Pete?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Well, he talks about polyunsaturated fatty acids and that they're harmful to the body. They disrupt thyroid-stimulating hormones. And
I agree with that.
Okay, so he was recommending, instead of getting bone density scans, to do a bone density sonogram, because the side effects of a sonogram are that they increase your bone mass, and the side effects of the X-ray bone scans are they decrease bone mass.
That's, you know, there are really limitations to the current methods of bone density assessment. One of those is that, you know, there's a margin of error with the machinery that may be greater than the change in your bone density between the 2 and 3 years. So I know, you know, practitioners are recommending now to have bone density scans if you're going to go that route less often, and I would agree with that. And also, the thing about the bone density scans is it has caused us to just focus on density of the bones as a determinant of bone health. But in fact, there are a number of other factors that contribute to our bone health other than just bone density. So people can become very emotional about their bone density and small changes, but in fact, there are other aspects of your bone microarchitecture, so the very smallest structure of your bone that contribute to the whether or not you're going to suffer a fracture. So we really need to keep the whole bone density scanning in its place, and I certainly would be open to hearing about Dr. Pete's alternate suggestions, but I think that you know, our current method of bone density scanning isn't giving us the whole story about our bone health.
But you wouldn't be familiar with bone density sonograms?
I'm not, no.
Okay. In the book, you talk about K2 making for easier labor. I'm sure there's lots of people who would be interested in hearing about that.
Oh, very important, yes. you know, K2 is so important during all throughout pregnancy, the first trimester for the development of the primary teeth in the fetus, and then the second trimester for the development of the adult teeth as well as the facial structure. And in the third trimester, K2 levels have been shown to actually drop in pregnant women. So that is a time when the fetus seems to be taking up more K2, and we need to make sure that our levels are high. And yes, even in labor. So we know absolutely with vitamin D that individuals who are D deficient are more likely to end up with a cesarean section. And I do look at the historical evidence where the intake of these nutrients has changed and then led to a dramatic change in the ability to give birth. And so labor is one that is really important. Purely anecdotally, I had exceptionally much more quick labor with my second child, who I just gave birth to, versus my first, after having supplemented and made sure I had lots of K2 in my diet, as well as other, all the fat-soluble vitamins together really will help.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a really important one for women who are planning a family, pregnant, nursing, and with young children.
Mm. You mentioned vitamin D being converted into a hormone in the body.
Yes, ultimately, vitamin D in our diet is converted to a form of vitamin D that affects our DNA, so that does have hormonal activity.
Does K2 also do that in the body, or is that known, or it's unknown?
It doesn't, actually. So vitamins A and D are essentially, when we take them in our diet, are hormonal precursors, and they ultimately will be changed into forms that have hormonal effects in the body, which means they will attach to our DNA and cause that DNA to produce proteins. But K2 doesn't have this type of hormonal action. K2 will just activate K2-dependent proteins that move calcium around the body. Now, that actually is a good thing because K2 is a fat-soluble vitamin that has no known toxicity. Vitamins A and D have potential toxicity because of their hormonal activity, but K2 has no toxicity whatsoever.
Mm. And I've mentioned vitamin A a few times now in the interview, but I haven't asked you to stress the importance of the balancing act between AD and K2.
And that is so important because, you know, as much good news as we've heard about vitamin D, it seems like it's all bad news about vitamin A, or vitamin A is just not being talked about at all. And the sources of vitamin A that we used to have in our diet, like a regular dose of cod liver oil or eating liver on a regular basis, those have more or less fallen by the wayside. And so that's why I do devote a chapter of the book, a whole chapter, to the relationship between these three nutrients, vitamins A, D, and K2. And essentially, you can think of vitamins A and D as like the gas and brakes on a car. You really do need them both for the vehicle to function optimally. And so it's no good saying that, you know, D is all good and we should all load up on D, and A is dangerous, for example, for our bones, which is a popular myth about vitamin A. We really do need all of these nutrients working together. When you have vitamins A and D in your diet, working together, they will produce those K2-dependent proteins, which have a lot of potential health benefits. And then when K2 is there, those potential benefits will be realized, and that's really where we see the optimal health for our bones and our teeth and our arteries and, you know, diabetes, fertility, cancer, all of those things.
And is my memory correct that the vitamin A helps to break down old bones?
Yes, it does. And that's an important part of bone remodeling. And it also helps to remove calcium from the body, which we all think, oh, that's not a good thing. We don't want to lose calcium from the body. But we do, in fact, want to be removing calcium from the arteries. So it sounds convenient. You might think that, okay, well, the body's going to take calcium out of your arteries and put it into your bones. That's very efficient, but it doesn't actually work that way. Once calcium has been removed from the arteries, it is then excreted or cleared from the body, and vitamin A helps do that. So there absolutely are instances in which we want to remove calcium from the body, and vitamin A will help us do that.
So then in some instances, if a doctor was checking for calcium in the urine, it may not be a bad thing if it was coming in this way?
It may not be a bad thing, yes. And we know that there is a sort of a variation, an annual excretion of calcium from the urine that varies in a natural way, because there are times when we want to have more calcium uptake to improve our bone health, and there's times we want to excrete more calcium to help get it out of the arteries.
So isn't it what the prescription drug Fosamax does, is it blocks the things that break down the bones?
Yes, that's right. But ultimately what we find with Fosamax and some of the other prescription bone medications, that we see an improvement in bone strength for about 2 years. And then after that point in time, there is an increase in the number of fractures that we see, and that the bone structure and microarchitecture and the bone strength after a period of 2 years is ultimately not as good. And so where we may see improved hip strength, then we see weakened strength of the femur, and we have individuals breaking their legs for no particular reason except for as a side effect of these medications. And so they do have their place in very limited use, but ultimately they're not necessarily improving the health of the bone over the long term.
And so that could be because all they're doing is building bone and not taking out any of the old things that need to be removed periodically.
Exactly. You're exactly right. So bone, maintaining healthy bone is a process of taking out old deteriorated bone and replacing that with new healthy bone. It's no good in just constantly building up new bone, because eventually the structure of the bone won't be healthy and strong.
I thought that was a very interesting nuance that you got to the bottom of in the vitamin A chapter.
And that's really important, because vitamin A has been maligned as being bad, exclusively bad for your bones, but really we do need it to maintain a good bone integrity.
So where would listeners go to look for vitamin K2 supplements, and what should they be looking for in them?
Vitamin K2 supplements should be pretty easy to find now in most health food stores. And if they don't have it at your favorite health food store or natural supplement store, they can easily order it in for you. And I do recommend for people to look for MK7, menaquinone 7, that's the technical name, or it may say bacterial derived or from natto bean somewhere on the label, but typically look for MK7. And you want to be taking about 200 micrograms per day. That's usually with food, because it's a fat-soluble vitamin, and 200 micrograms of this MK7 form has been shown, according to the most recent studies, to be enough to activate all of your proteins to keep calcium where it should be in your bones.
And that would be recommended for any person, even without knowing that they have osteoporosis or atherosclerosis or any of those?
Definitely. Because K2 has no toxic effect, and because heart disease, osteoporosis, diabetes, those concerns are so common, and that there are so many other benefits to vitamin K2, that would be a recommended dosage really for everyone.
And so even someone who has a more serious problem, they wouldn't want to increase that amount, they'd stay with the 200?
It wouldn't hurt to increase that amount, and dosing studies looking at what the optimal dosage and requirements may be for different health conditions are ongoing.
Uh-huh.
And I certainly have people emailing me that they have taken higher than that and seen good results. So it's something that you can experiment with or take more.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to mention before we wrap up?
You know what, Pete? I think we really did a pretty good job at covering the gamut of the different aspects and importance of vitamin K2. One thing, though, that I would like to remind people is that, as I mentioned before, the story of K2 is really so much more important than even the story of nutrition. So for anybody who is interested in what they eat and why and their health for any reason, it's worthwhile checking out the book.
Dr. Kate, thank you so much, and I would recommend your book to anyone out there. It's just a great read, very fascinating.
Thanks, Pete. Appreciate that.
Take care.
You too.